Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs here at Princeton University, and this is my co-host and colleague, Sam.
Hi there. Sam Wong here, professor of neuroscience and molecular biology, also faculty associate in law and public affairs.
One of the issues that's been front and center of American political debate, both under the Obama administration and even in the 2016 campaign, has been work and labor and the struggles of many middle-class Americans to keep their jobs, to achieve the kind of security that was once something that was almost automatic back in the 1940s and 50s and 1960s, the height of the New Deal era. President Trump made much of his campaign about appealing to workers and in his first 100 days has continued to promise to bring jobs back to the United States. And the Democratic campaign in the primaries also often revolved around the question of work as Senator Sanders posed a challenge to Senator Clinton sometimes around what each candidate would do for this. There's many critics who argue that not much is actually being done in the first few months of this administration, that a lot of this has been more about rhetoric than about policy. And I think there's many who agree that with all the noise in the political sphere in general, there hasn't been enough attention to this fundamental question. So today we have with us Christopher Liu, who is the former U.S. Deputy Secretary of Labor under President Obama, to speak with us about these issues. He served in a number of other positions, including Assistant to the President and White House Cabinet Secretary from 2009 to 2013. Co-chair of the White House Initiative on Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. He was the legislative director from 2005 to 2009 and acting chief of staff for Senator Obama. He also handled the transition for President Obama when he became president, which is something I hope we might discuss during this interview. He also served and worked for Senator John Kerry during his 2004 campaign, and earlier in his career was deputy chief counsel for the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. So someone who has served in various perspectives, understanding how government does or does not work. So welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So maybe we can just start off by hearing a little bit about your assessment of how the Trump administration is doing with regard to the question of helping workers.
I think the challenge for the Trump folks right now is that this is a president who campaigned on increasing jobs, on growing wages, and so far his job plan has essentially consisted of taking credit for job announcements previously announced, as well as tweet shaming companies to keep their operations in the United States. That's not a comprehensive job creation strategy. And you're right in the introduction, Julian. This is not just a policy issue. It's a political issue. The Trump voters are the Sanders voters. And as we consider more broadly where our economy is, there is a genuine need for policymakers to understand how we create good-paying jobs in this country right now. It is both possible to say that we are in the midst of one of the greatest economic recoveries in history, and at the same time to say for the vast majority of Americans, their lives have not improved over the last 20 or 30 years. And I don't think from a Democratic or Republican perspective, we know what the answers necessarily are to helping to address that problem.
Cynics will say, or critics from the right, that there's not much government can do about this problem. This is an issue that must be left to free markets and to changes in the economy. But you have served, you know, right in the heart of a government body that deals with these labor questions. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about, from your experience, what you've seen government to address these kinds of challenges.
Well, it's interesting. As we record this, we are nearing the 100-day mark for President Trump. In the first 100 days of the Obama administration, we passed an $800 billion stimulus package that, according to economists, created about 3 million jobs. How did we do that? We invested in infrastructure. We put money into job training. We invested into broadband, the things that we know that can create jobs in this country right now. But beyond that, we need to invest in job training. There are about 5.5 million open jobs in this country right now. And as the Deputy Secretary of Labor, when I traveled around the country, I talked to business executives all the time who said, look, I'm ready to expand my operations here in the United States, but I can't find enough trained workers. And through the Department of Labor, we put out billions of dollars of job training money each year. We also know that we need to raise wages in the country, and it's one of the reasons why the Obama administration pushed for an increase in the minimum wage. It's also one of the reasons why we push for paid family leave and paid sick leave policies, because there are far too many women who are sitting on the sidelines right now not participating. So I agree and I disagree. The government can't do it all, but government can play an important role.
So talking about job training, some students of mine actually for a term project this semester have been looking at Bureau of Labor Statistics categories, right, area by area, whether it be personal services, home health care, steel workers, what have you, and looking at geographic patterns of job loss. And when we talk about job training, what they've been showing me is that there are specific areas that came up in the election, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Western Pennsylvania, where traditional job categories are shrinking and some substantial numbers of people are losing their jobs. So when job training programs are implemented, to what extent are they targeted? Is this a top-down process or is this something that happens at state governments?
Well, the funding comes from top-down, but it's obviously in conjunction with state and local governments. And as importantly, it's in conjunction with the local workforce boards, which are made up of union leaders. It's made up of business executives. When you see this work, you need workforce development and economic development working hand in glove. But you raise a broader issue, Sam, which is this. If you go back 20 or 30 years ago, you could have a high school student, a high school graduate from one of the regions that you just mentioned, who could go and get a good-paying factory job, union factory job, that would allow them to raise a family, buy a home, save for their retirement. They'd get a pension through that company. Those jobs don't exist anymore. And I don't think policymakers, whether it's at the federal or state level, have quite figured out yet how to bring those jobs back to the areas that you mentioned. If you go to places like Denver and Phoenix, they're booming. There's not a problem right now with jobs there. But how do you bring back those jobs to the coal areas that Donald Trump says he wants to help? How do you get people to locate their businesses there?
So his idea of helping is in a very literal sense, I'm going to do something about your specific jobs today by shaming, as Julian put it. So that's the approach that we've been hearing about in the news. But now you're talking about something else, which is doing something like retraining them for jobs that aren't coming back.
Well, that's the problem. Look, we have lost more jobs in the retail sector than we have lost in the coal industry. And I don't see a massive government bailout right now of shopping malls around the country. Coal is going away, and it's going away for a lot of reasons that have nothing to do with the environmental regulations of the Obama administration. And so when those jobs go away, how do you train those people for the jobs that exist in those regions? And more importantly, how do you get the companies to relocate to those areas?
So this is sector after sector. At one point, it was coal mining, then it's retail. You know, in 10 years, maybe it's going to be driving as self-driving cars go into common use. And so this is a technologically driven wave of displacement that's going to keep on moving.
You're absolutely right. For all the conversations about the effects of trade on job loss, it's really automation. It's technology that's driving a lot of these jobs away. You know, in the U.S. manufacturing sector right now, compared to 20 years ago, we're producing twice as many goods with 30% fewer workers. And that's going to continue to happen. And so no amount of tweet shaming by the president is going to keep companies here if it's not profitable to make your goods here. As I always tell people, look, if you want to go to a Walmart and buy a $6 T-shirt, you can basically guarantee that T-shirt's not being made in the United States. And so instead of stopping innovation, instead of stopping the normal movement of companies and goods, how do we anticipate where our economy is going to be in the next couple of decades and then ensure that we have the trained workforce for those jobs?
Could I ask the other – so there's job training and obviously there's tax policies that affect this. The other part in American history of what the government did was to actually provide jobs. And it's just in New York, and I went by the Tweed Courthouse. So this was on my mind. And there was that era of machine politics where the government provided work. There was the New Deal era through the 60s where that still was pretty fundamental.
Right, you could drive across Pennsylvania and just see these great tunnels that were constructed as part of that boom.
And President Obama did some of that with the stimulus package as well, although it's interesting he was careful, from what we've learned at least, not to boast too much about that part of the program. So now we have this infrastructure debate also that's kind of looming. Do you think there's any possibility that that could happen, that you could have a bipartisan program that provides public works once again, or is that not really on the table?
I am optimistic that one area that we could find bipartisan agreement is around infrastructure, because that's always the area that we've done it in the past. There are no Democratic or Republican bridges or roads. There's just bridges and roads. And whether from a job training perspective, whether it's stimulating the manufacturing industry in this country, whether it's frankly dealing with the genuine infrastructure problems we have in this country, it's important. And when the president talks about a $1 trillion plan, Democrats say, we think that's great. The only question is how one funds that and what the projects we put money into are, whether these are simply ones that can be turned into profit-generating enterprises for the private sector, or are these the areas that we really need the investments? Is somebody going to put money into, for instance, shoring up the water infrastructure system in Flint, Michigan? Is that a target of an infrastructure bill? Probably not.
One thing, I just mentioned this in my question, but since you're here, I'd love to ask you, did President Obama and the administration do enough to sell what the stimulus was doing? Or when you hear critics who say he was too hands-off and didn't message or, you know, put the Obama sign on the public works programs that were going on, was there a mistake in the administration that ultimately didn't give the administration the credit many think it deserved?
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think we did enough. I mean, for a period of time in 2009, 2010, when you would drive around and see a bridge that we were rehabbing because of stimulus funds, you would every now and then see an American Recovery and Reinvestment Act sign. That was probably a little too obscure for most people to understand how that was being funded. And I do think in the messaging of the first term, we were too reluctant to take a victory lap. I'll even tell you, by the second term, when I was at the Department of Labor, every month Tom Perez, my boss, and I would go up and do press. We would talk about, you know, this is the longest streak of job creation in history, but we would always talk about the unfinished business, which was wages. And I think so we were probably intellectually honest to an extent that, I'll be honest, the current administration is not, in terms of bragging about their accomplishments. We probably should have taken a victory lap more. But in part, that reflected our understanding of where working class Americans were. Yes, they were working, but there was wage stagnation. When you look at kind of the broad middle of the demographics in this country, most people have not gotten a wage increase over the last 20 or 30 years, and all of their living expenses have increased. So yeah, they have a job, but they don't feel like their lives are improving. And I think that was what was underlying some of our reluctance not to take that victory lap.
So given the landscape of where things are now, so there's all this messaging by tweet, in terms of what might happen under current congressional control, under the current administration, under a current landscape that's, you know, not very productive legislatively, can you imagine a thing that could happen, whether above the radar or under the radar?
In terms of infrastructure?
No, I'm sort of kind of on Julian's question about, you know, he was asking about the stimulus package. And so I guess, I mean, it could be infrastructure, I guess. So you're saying infrastructure is going to be the way forward?
I think infrastructure is one of the way forward. And I think the challenge that President Trump has right now is whether he's created so much ill will already with his tactics over the first 100 days, with his tweets about Democrats, whether he's poisoned the waters that they will whether they'll want to work with him or not. It is an interesting thing about whether you can move the economy more broadly with the presidential bully pulpit. Is there some number of tweets that will so sufficiently embarrass companies that they will want to keep their operations here? Maybe at the margins. You know, what you saw with the carrier deal at the end of last year is, you know, 800 jobs did not leave Indiana. Still, 1,200 did leave. And Carrier, I think, as a subsidiary of United Technologies, made a broader decision that, you know what, we don't want to jeopardize our government contracts. So maybe this is not the most profitable place to keep a business, but we're willing to do this to stay on the right side of the present. Is that a long-term job creation strategy? I don't think so.
It just feels kind of small ball to me to call it one company at a time.
And I don't think there's enough. In fact, there's not enough tweets in the world that can actually do that. And you're right, it's completely small ball.
Could I ask a different kind of question? You have known former President Obama for a long time.
We were law school classmates.
You were law school classmates, so you really know him. You understand him.
Legislative director for his Senate office.
And so kind of you understand his temperament and how he operated. One of the things we discussed the other day on the podcast is, you know, one part of the 100 days is the learning, not so much just the accomplishments, but do people learn? Do they adjust? Do they get a feel? And I'm curious, from watching President Obama, how did that happen in the first 100 days? Did he change and adjust from the person you knew before the campaign? And then I'm curious if you think that might happen with our current president.
You know, I will tell you, Julian, having known Barack Obama now for 25 years, he's remarkably the same person now as he was 25 years ago in law school. We always joke that he sort of came out fully formed in a way that very few of us have. Look, learning how to do the job of president is something that nothing trains you for. And he understood this. Senator Obama understood this. You know, he had 4 years in the U.S. Senate. He had 8 years as a Illinois state senator. So he didn't have the experience in the executive branch. And it's one of the reasons why he surrounded himself with a lot of people who did know how government works. And I think and I think just as importantly, he had the capacity to learn and adjust and grow. This is not the first president that we're facing right now who has struggled in their first 100 days. The stories abound about President Clinton's first 100 days, but he had the capacity to learn and adjust.
So just to point out, I was just looking at some disapproval numbers. If you look at the last, 10 administrations or so, going back to JFK, the highest disapproval at the 100-day mark until this point was Bill Clinton at 37%. And of course, as most people know, Trump is bested that by a substantial margin. So there appears to be some relationship between struggling the first 100 days and public disapproval.
Absolutely. I mean, this is really the high water mark in terms of polling, I would think, for the Trump administration, although it probably reflects just as much the increasing polarization in our country. Right. With each administration we've had, the last couple, it has been the most polarized in U.S. history. And that is probably a reflection of what's happening in society more broadly. So I guess the broader question with the problematic 100 days that Donald Trump has had, does he have the ability to learn and adjust and grow? And I would posit that a 70-year-old businessman who has run his family business in a certain way his entire life probably is not likely to change. You know, what has been striking over the last couple of days, some of the interviews, is, you know, him learning, for instance, that healthcare is kind of a complicated thing. Or, you know what, there's kind of a long history of problematic relations on the Korean Peninsula between Korea and China. Or his interview with Reuters where he said, wow, I didn't know this job would be that hard. That's the level of self-realization and self-awareness. There's no self-awareness that, hey, you know, maybe your tweets are not helpful to your own policy agenda. They're certainly not helpful to the conduct of foreign policy. So I'm not sure he's learning.
But this has to do with the mediaization. I mean, he's not necessarily any different from any regular citizen who gets information through cable news and through email forwards from friends. He probably thinks that being president is what you see on TV, as opposed to all those meetings. I don't know. Think of those thousands of hours you've spent with your law school pal who became president, those thousands of hours or whatever, you know, whatever hundreds of hours doing the work of being chief of staff or, you know, legislative director or what have you. He doesn't see that, right?
Right. He sees in terms of wins and losses. He sees in terms of allies and enemies. It's a very black and white world that he views politics. And what is striking is some of the reporting that's come out over the last couple of days. He is more interested in trying to get a deal done on healthcare than he is on what the contents of the healthcare bill are. That's not the president I worked for. We weren't just about winning. We were about making the right policy, even if you disagreed what our policy was.
Now, you were at the top of a transition. No, most people have no idea what that entails, other than putting a few people in the jobs that they see on television. Could you maybe compare how that process worked from at least what you know of the transition that President Trump had undertaken and how this might affect what's going on right now?
Sure. I started planning the presidential transition with Senator Obama in May of 2008, 6 full months before he was elected president. We even started planning before he had even wrapped up the Democratic nomination. And we did it in several work streams. It was not only identifying potential personnel to work in the administration. It was understanding what our policy goals were, understanding how the federal agencies worked and how the agencies could help our policy agenda. So we relied on a respected group of volunteers. John Podesta was our chairman. John had been the White House chief of staff under the Clinton administration. We had people like Carol Browner, the former EPA administrator, Susan Rice, who became the national security advisor. Some of the most esteemed minds in the Democratic Party were working on our transition because we understood that you needed to start planning early because if you simply waited till Election Day, in 2008, we had 77 days between Election Day and Inauguration Day. That was no way to put together a federal government. If you take a step back, it is really remarkable that we even have a presidential transition. This is not what happens in other countries. We have 2 million federal civil servants, and on Inauguration Day, the 4,000 political appointees who run the federal government leave their jobs, and you need to find new people to fill it. You would never do that with any – you would certainly not do that with a university, and you would certainly not do that with any Fortune 500 company, and you're doing that with the largest organization, most powerful organization in the world. So early and careful planning makes a difference. What happened with the Trump administration, the pre-Trump administration, I think, frankly, was probably a lack of recognition that they would win. So they didn't put the amount of effort into it. Governor Christie was leading the efforts. And then soon after Election Day, Governor Christie was pushed aside as well as his people and his plans, the transition plans, and they started over again. And so what you've seen in this administration is they've been very slow to put personnel in place. Of the 550 top jobs in the administration that require Senate confirmation, only about 25 have been filled at this point. In important departments like State and Defense and Treasury, there is not a Senate-confirmed person below the secretarial level. On top of all that, you have two other dynamics. You have the lack of a policy agenda by candidate Trump. He essentially ran a campaign devoid of policy. And so a lot of what they've been doing is trying to translate his rhetoric from these campaign rallies into more fulsome policies. And second dynamic is that they really have established a litmus test for serving in the administration. If you have been critical of the president, if you've been a never-Trumper, you're disqualified. And so they've basically leaving a lot of people out of the administration.
And you're saying that that was not true in the transition that you ran, that people who are against Obama during the primaries or spoke out against him could get a job?
Oh, believe me. Our administration was stocked with a lot of people who supported Hillary Clinton during our primary. We included a lot of Republicans in our administration as well, several members of Congress. People forget that we appointed John Huntsman as ambassador to China. A number of our Secretary of the Army was a Republican. Our Secretary of Transportation was a Republican, Ray LaHood. You know, President Obama told us that he wanted an administration that reflected the diversity of the country. And he didn't just mean racial and gender and sexual orientation diversity. He wanted people from all walks of life, private sector, public sector, Democrats, Republicans, state and local government, because that's the only way to run a country.
So thinking about this lack of policy agenda that you're saying that Trump had during the campaign, let's think here. So you said that about 95% of positions requiring Senate confirmation are as yet unfilled as of today. One counterargument would be, let's take a fairly popular point of view on the Republican side, which is a lot of these agencies shouldn't be putting their heavy hand on the American economy, on the American people, whether it be education or labor.
The environment.
And so so maybe the way to get their policy goals as a party, not Trump, the president, but the Republican Party, is to not have people in those positions. What's the difference between not having positions and say, let's say I wanted to alter workplace regulations, or I want to alter environmental regulations. Am I better off having people actively in those positions?
Well, I think it's two things. I mean, first of all, I would say it is agencies like State, Defense, and Treasury where this new administration does have an agenda that it wants to move forward on, and you don't have people who can implement that. But even on the agencies like labor, like environment, where these are, you know, traditionally at cross purposes with Republican orthodoxy, if you want to turn the ship of government, you need somebody at the helm of the ship. Today, as when we tape this, you've got a Secretary of Labor who is going to be confirmed and going to be sworn in. That's one person sitting on top of 17,000 employees who are used to doing their jobs in a certain way. That one person can't turn that ship by him or herself.
Can I just ask on that, what do you think of the new Secretary of Labor? What are your impressions?
Acosta.
I don't know him. He has a record of public service, which I appreciate. He is, I will say, certainly better than the first nominee, Andy Puzder, the CEO of Carl's Jr., who really was kind of the poster child for bad labor practices. I don't believe whether the Secretary of Labor is Andy Puzder or Alex Acosta really makes a difference. I think it's the agenda, the labor, the worker agenda of the Trump administration will be decided by the White House. And the key question always is Donald Trump going to live up to his campaign promises of helping working class Americans who want job opportunities, who want their wages to go up, who wanted to be protected in the workplace? You've seen a schizophrenic administration where you had a very populist presidential candidate who has come in and taken more conventional Wall Street positions along the way. So the Department of Labor is one of the places where you can make a difference. So far in the first 100 days, I haven't seen any evidence of a pro-worker agenda, but we'll see what happens.
You believe that there was a genuine populism there, or was that simply an election ploy?
You know, far be it for me to get into the head of Donald Trump as to whether he sincerely believes in this or not. But let me tell you, certainly his supporters believe that he cares about them and that he's going to bring jobs back to their area.
And do you think, that, again, from your work in the Obama administration, there were Democratic critics who criticized the administration and said, in the end, he didn't do enough to live up to some of that rhetoric and too close to Wall Street, all the arguments you heard in the primaries. How do you respond when you hear that complaint that in the end, he didn't in some ways live up to the New Deal legacy of the party?
I think one of the challenges is this. You know, people forget. And you go back 8 years ago when Barack Obama came into office, we were in the midst of the greatest economic downturn in our country's history. We were on the brink of the next Great Depression. I remember sitting in the Roosevelt Room when we got the first jobs numbers from January of 2009. We lost 800,000 jobs in 1 month. That's more than the number of people in Charlotte, North Carolina. So the overwhelming goal of the first term of the administration was to right the economic ship. And the fact that we are now at a point of time of 4.5% unemployment, we've had job growth for 6-7 years is evidence that our policies worked. We shored up the auto industry. We got health care for 24 million people in this country. We put sensible regulations in place around the financial industry to prevent another downturn. I think history will judge us well for saving the country from what could have been a disastrous consequence. But you're right. It's hard to message. We saved you from something really bad. And certainly on a lot of the issues that the really hardcore progressive issues that the Democratic base supports, these are things that we turn to, you know, in the second term of the administration, once the economic ship had been righted. A lot of these things were done through regulation, frankly, because we did not have control of Congress. And so some of them are at danger of being overturned because of the new administration.
Did President Obama see the kind of energy on the right? I mean, this is another question that people have. At the end, he gave this great interview with David Remnick in the New Yorker, and he's talking about the election after it happened, and he's saying we should have seen this coming. And he kind of goes through the history of the Tea Party.
You're talking about all the venom that surrounded the
first— Right, bringing down Speaker Boehner, and that this was where it was going. We should have seen it. And there's a question if he was kind of still so inspired by his own message back in 2004 that he didn't see where the party was moving. And this would have effects, obviously, on governance. What did you see?
I think we saw it. I mean, people forget when the president went before the joint session of Congress, and I think it was October of 2009, to talk about health care. Remember, Joe Wilson stood up and said, "You lie." That was an incredible breach of protocol. But I think it was the beginning of that Tea Party movement that ended up taking away the House majority from us, and I think in many ways then challenged the rest of our agenda for the remaining 6 years. So I think, look, we saw the protests in the Tea Party. We saw the increasing stridency of the Republican Party. You know, President Obama tried to cut the grand bargain with Speaker Boehner for a long period of time. And I think he believed and still believes that Speaker Boehner is a good man who could not cut the deal because of the hardcore people in his base. You know, it is incredible as we kind of, you know, every couple years had to struggle with government shutdowns, with raising the debt ceiling, that there's a faction of people in this in the U.S. Congress who don't want government to work, who actually think it's a good thing that the U.S. defaults on its obligations or doesn't see the bad thing of that. So I think we got a sense of that. Whether we could have anticipated the rise of Trump, I don't know. If we failed to anticipate it, I would say that the whole political class failed to see that as well.
Well, to what extent? I mean, at some level, these things are continuing now, right, with the so-called Freedom Caucus basically being okay with shutting everything down. Now on the Democratic side, now liberals have gotten movements like the so-called Resist movement, the Indivisible movement. It seems like there's some of that same energy appearing now. Well, first off, the same continuing trend about people who would like to just shut down government. Now, in addition to that, some kind of, you know, liberal version of that same rage happening on the left now. So it seems like things are, if anything, getting more intense than they were when you worked in the administration.
Yeah, and I will tell you, as we said at the outset, you know, with each administration, it's the most polarized administration in history. And you not only see that in terms of public opinion polls about the president, you see that in terms of the voting patterns of members of Congress. If you go back to the Ronald Reagan, Tip O'Neill days, there was such a thing as, you know, moderate Republicans, Northeast moderate Republicans. There were blue dog Democrats, and there were hundreds of these people. I mean, you could cut a deal with people in the center. If you were to graph out the members of Congress now and their voting record, there's virtually no overlap between the two parties right now. Add on top of that redistricting issues and how for most members of Congress, the most difficult race they will face is in their primary, not in the general election. It's not the recipe for great success at the federal level.
You might think that Trump could be an upending figure where if he did it right, he could break down party strictures just by not being in any debt to his own party and being able to cut deals and so on. It feels like if he had a longer attention span, this would be within his reach.
Oh, believe me, I've always said not that I will get my half hour with Donald Trump. If I ever got a half hour with Donald Trump, I'd say, look, here's the playbook. It's the Mike Bloomberg playbook in New York. There's a person who was elected mayor without the support of a party and governed really right down the middle and will be known as one of the most successful mayors in U.S. history. Donald Trump could follow that same model because he does not owe his election to the Republican establishment. But so far, over the first 100 days, there's no sense that he's going to follow that path.
Is there a infrastructure labor policy that he could put out right now, going back to the first part of our conversation, that you as an advisor would say to Democrats, despite the politics, this is something you need to think about? What would that be?
Well, you saw this start to come up a little bit during the campaign where he talked about a paid leave policy, and it seems to be one that his daughter has pushed as well. If there were a paid family leave policy that applied to mothers and fathers alike, I think it would be very hard for Democrats to oppose that.
And what does that mean, that the federal government would finance the leave? How does that work?
Well, I think that's the financing becomes a little bit an issue, whether it's an employer funded, whether it's partially employer employee, whether it's payroll taxes, whatever it is. I think that the funding mechanism, I think, is always the devil in the detail. But to have a president of the United States come out, a Republican president, and say, you know what, mothers and fathers should have the right to take time off, pay time off to take care of a new child, that would be pretty transformative.
On that policy, why don't more Republicans on the Hill support that? That seems to be a family values economic policy.
You know, it's boggling to me because, when I, as the Deputy Secretary of Labor, traveled around to talk to employers, most Fortune 500 companies have paid leave policies because they understand that, it is important as a recruiting tool, particularly those in Silicon Valley are really progressive workplace practices. So it's an important recruiting tool, but it's also an important retention tool. You know, employers will tell you that the cost of replacing an employee can be upwards of 1 year of their salary. And so, yeah, there's an upfront cost to providing paid leave, but you get that in terms – you more than get that back when that employee sticks with you longer and is productive throughout the course of their lifetime. And so it makes good business sense, which is why so many companies have endorsed that policy. I think from the Republican perspective, I think what they oppose is a government mandate telling companies to do that.
Feels like politically a lot of these things are going to have to wait until, frankly, the next midterm election, where it's just hard to imagine Democrats in either the House or the Senate wanting to get into a discussion under current legislative conditions. I mean, not just this, but like let's say infrastructure. In order, if I'm a Democrat, then I want infrastructure to focus on centrally funded projects that build up infrastructure where there are people living. But if I'm a Republican, maybe what I want is tax credits. And so just the leverage that Democrats have is not terribly good right now, or maybe it is, given the Freedom Caucus's withdrawal from the process.
Yeah, it's amazing how the political calendar shrinks. I mean, you know, within 6 months to 8 months, we're going to be, you know, in midterm election time. Right after that, we're in presidential election time. It's hard to imagine much happening at this point. I think that's why, as I think about the wasted opportunities of this first 100 days, it's frankly not going to get a whole lot better for the administration after that. But what I am encouraged by—
Not because they don't have any more days, but just because it illustrates how prepared they are for whatever they might do in the next 100 days.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. And I do think that just the calendar starts to shrink. I mean, we had talked about trying to get tax reform done before August. I think that looks pretty problematic at this point. It looks like infrastructure probably gets pushed into next year.
Ooh. Election year.
But exactly. But I think what you do— I think, again, under Democratic control and Republican control, Washington has made itself irrelevant because of its partisanship and gridlock. But what you see happening is at the state and local level, really interesting policies happening, whether it's on the issues I care about, like paid leave, like minimum wage, interesting environmental regulations. You have a plethora of just sort of experimentation, really the kind of classic laboratory of democracy idea we talk about. Now, what that does for business certainty is a whole other thing. But you've got lots of action happening outside of Washington.
Do you see action at the state level on the Republican side? Like, how is it distributed across, you know, because so many states have single party control?
Well, it is a troubling thing if you sort of think about issues like health care, for instance. You've got a health care alternative that's being put forth right now that would allow states to waive certain requirements like unessential health benefits or to create risk pools for pre-existing conditions. So you could have wealthier states that were more wealthier, more progressive states that were likely to be more generous in healthcare than poor, more Republican states. I mean, there really ought to be a base level of benefits. Again, whether we're talking about the health space, labor space, whatever, environmental regulations. Experimentation is good as long as we have a floor.
Well, but for instance, like say Utah, for example, that's an example of a heavily Republican state that might be inclined to, in fact, move forward in some of these domains that you've talked about.
Exactly. And you've got California and New York going the other directions as well.
We're almost out of time, but there, as a historian, since you're here, let me ask, is there a moment you remember with President Obama during your time in the White House that for you captures what his presidency was about? I don't know if something comes to mind.
Exactly. It was in late 2010. It was probably December of 2010. President Obama signed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I remember, and it was not an issue I'd worked on, but I went to the bill signing ceremony, and it was in the Department of Interior Auditorium, which is one of the bigger auditoriums in the federal government, about 800 people. And in the audience, there were gay service members, gay veterans there with their partners and spouses, tears running down their eyes as well as everyone else who was witnessing that. And you realize that this is really one of the last civil rights, not last, we have many civil rights challenges, one of the remaining civil rights challenges of our generation. And no matter who would come after this president, you could never go back. I mean, this was a big step forward, and you certainly saw this in terms of the Supreme Court's decision on marriage equality as well. We as a country were genuinely moving forward, notwithstanding all the other problems we had in our country, and that's one that still stands out to me.
Well, with that, we're going to have to wrap up our episode. Let us both thank Christopher Liu again for joining us, and thank you for your service in all branches of government. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And thanks to everyone, and Sam and I will be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Take care. Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series about the 2016 presidential election produced by WooCast. The content discussed in this podcast is intended to be informational only. It does not represent nor reflect the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.